Welcome, everyone. My name is David Greenwalt with Leanest Lifestyle University, and today I have on the phone with me Dr. Brian Wansink, who wrote a book called Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Wansink.
Well, it's great to be with you, David.
Let's just start right off here. What does it mean to mindlessly eat when it's not working in our favor?
Yeah, no, it's not. But, you know, regardless of how tuned in we think we are to our food environment, we are just a nation of mindless eaters. But that's the good news, because a lot of the things that influence what we do, that cause us to maybe eat a little bit more than we otherwise would, the person who's sitting next to us, the size of our plate, the lighting in the room, where the music's playing, those things can also be changed to work in our favor. And that's why I say the solution to mindless eating, for most of us, may not be mindful eating. Because for a lot of us, you know, you've got full-time jobs, you've got a to-do list that goes on forever, the kids are screaming, the microwave's buzzing. For most of us, the solution to mindless eating is simply to make some small changes in our life that enable us to mindlessly eat better rather than mindlessly eat too much.
Got it. So the idea is to move from, we're still going to mindlessly eat, but instead of just being completely unaware of our surroundings and environment and what's going on, we want to make the small changes so that it doesn't feel like we're really doing all that much, but we are.
Yeah, right. I mean, so our research showed that basically, let's say the size of a plate, if you go from 9.5 inches to 12 inches, which is what most of us have in our cupboard, you eat about 23% more. Well, instead of saying, well, let me not eat 23% more, you know, just use smaller plates. Or if the shape of a glass causes you to pour more, you know, milk or soda pop or whatever, use a tall, skinny glass and a short, white glass. I mean, there are about 150 things we've kind of discovered through our research here at the Cornell Food and Brand Lab that unknowingly trip us up. And then the solution to it is not knowing it. Because we all know, for instance, that a Snicker bar has more calories than an apple, but we always want the Snicker bar. And knowing the size of a plate, or that having a candy bowl with an arm's length versus 6 feet away causes us to eat twice as much, isn't going to do us any good. What we need to do is just make that easy step to just change our environment, and it mindlessly causes us to eat less.
What are these hidden persuaders you talk about in the book? Can you give an example?
Yeah. One illustration would be you open your cupboard, or you open your refrigerator, you open your pantry. The very first thing you see, okay, you are three times as likely to eat as the fifth thing you see. But what do most of us put in our cupboard as the first thing we see? Oh, it's the most unhealthy item. It's the first thing we see in our refrigerator is the stuff that's least healthy for the most part. And so what happens is we're naturally setting up our life so that we end up choosing the wrong thing rather than the right thing. So it's just as easy to do to kind of rearrange your refrigerator so that there's the cut-up vegetables or the fruit ends up being on that center shelf, you know, not that mayonnaise jar.
Yeah, it's again, making those small changes so that in our environment and our surroundings and in our habits or patterns or whatever, yeah, that they don't work against us, they work for us.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a ton of those changes in the book Mindless Eating, but there's also a ton of changes that people can just find in the website mindlesseating.org that can help them whatever their situation is. Because one of the things we find is that there are basically five situations in which we overeat. Okay, I mean, we meal stuff. Okay, we snack graze. We restaurant indulge. We party binge, and we desktop or dashboard dine, meaning we eat at our desk or our car. But the thing is, for any one of us, there's really only one of those things at any one time that's most troublesome. Okay? I mean, people who have a problem with meal stuffing, you know, usually also don't have the problem of snack grazing. No, because they're full until the next meal. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to identify what that let's call it the dietary danger zone is, for you specifically, ends up being the best starting point for making one or two small changes.
So review the five and look, you know, like you said, not all of them are going to be a problem for all of us.
That's exactly right. I mean, and there's some very easy kind of questionnaires and very easy sort of tests you can take to find out which one you are. I mean, they're at mindlesseating.org or in the book. But, you know, most of us know what our big problem is. I mean, you know, you and I, you know, as, you know, guys with families, we at home, our problem, if anything, might be probably meal stuffing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But when you were single, it might have been restaurant indulging.
Sure. Yeah, there's... It's very easy to see how, you know, one or two of those things are going to be the problems, and the others you're just going to shake your head and say, no, that doesn't apply to me.
Yeah. It,
you say it's easier to change our environment than change our mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, most diets that people go in, or rather, most diets that people go on end up being deprivation diets, meaning we deprive ourselves of something. You know, we say, I'm never going to eat pizza again in my life, or, you know, I'm giving up cheese for life, or, you know, no carbohydrates for me until I'm, you know, on my deathbed, or whatever. Okay. And the problem with these deprivation diets is that anytime we starve ourselves of something, whether it be carbohydrates or pizza or cheese or affection or TV or whatever, it really seems to find a way back to us. You know, it backfires in a lot of different ways. And the silver lining of willpower, you know, which is really limited, and particularly if you have a job that takes a lot of concentration, or you've got screaming kids that take a lot of your attention, or whatever, the best thing to do is just to set up sort of your environment in a very, very simple, easy way, so that you don't have to use willpower. You can instead just sort of rely on the things around you to bump you and nudge you sort of mindlessly in the right direction while you think about the things that are important, your kids, your work, or whatever.
Well, you say, I think just kind of exiting from that a little bit and leading into this, you say that to feel the change the least, you refer to staying within the mindless margin. What is that? And I think that's kind of what you're talking about here, staying within that.
Well, that's exactly right. And when I talk about the mindless margin, so... there's a certain amount of calories that each of us need every day to just sort of maintain our weight. Like, let's say, just for a round number, it's 2,000 calories. And if you eat 2,000 calories every day, you need to gain and lose weight. Well, all of a sudden, what happens when you're on a diet is you tend to drastically change that. You know, you cut down to 1,000 or something like that, or you eat lettuce with 400. Well, both your mind and your body know you're deprived. Your body responds by shutting down and sort of going into conservation mode, meaning you're not losing weight because it's just being really efficient. Your mind responds by saying, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, someday it's payback time. And all you can think about is how miserable you are and how at some point you're going to actually kind of, you know, be out of this taking the medicine kind of mode. Well, for most people, if you have a 2,000 calorie need, you can dip, our research shows, let's say 10 to 20% below that or 10 to 20% above that without realizing it. You know, meaning if you need 2,000 calories, you can have 1,600 a day and still kind of feel okay. But if you have 1,500 a day, you kind of go, man, I'm hungry. Similarly, you know, you can eat, you know, 2,200 calories and not really know you've eaten much more, but you eat 2,500 calories, you say, wow, I am really bloated. And so from our research, this is at the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, what we believe is that you really need to stay within this really small margin around what you typically need. And to be safe, it's 15 to 20% of your calories you typically need. Once you drop below that, you know you're doing your body wrong. And you're going to figure out a way to, many people will figure out a way to make that right.
Yeah, that's. I think that's very interesting. I don't know which came first there, the chicken or the egg on the whole small change philosophy, but it definitely follows along with that.
Well, yeah, and I, when I actually when I came out with the book and, a number of years ago, I met with the people who, then we wrote up the articles on the small change movement. So.
Okay.
It kind of came from the whole idea of, hey, look, really, you don't really need to make very many changes for it to make a huge difference in your life. And 200 calories, or let's say 400 calories a day, 400 calories is way too much if you cut that. So try to cut 200 calories or 250 calories. And boy, that's easily done by just changing the size of dishware. It's very easily done, by altering, how far your snack bowls are. It's very easily done by taking anything off your counter that isn't fruit.
Yeah, and as you said in the book, taking the things that we might have a tendency to overeat that are up front, stick them in the back.
Yeah.
You say our stomachs are bad at math and volume trumps calories. What do you mean?
No. Yeah, that's pretty true. Well, what happens is that a lot of people say, I know when I'm full. No, we don't know when you're full. We pretty much eat with our eyes and not with our stomach. Okay. We did a study a while back. We had a refillable soup bowl. We invented this. We invited people for lunch and they ate out of a soup bowl, but it refilled itself.
I love this, by the way. By the way, some of your examples that you gave on just some of the things that it's all research and it's all incredibly, impressive, but I almost got to call it shenanigans that you guys pull on some of your people. It's hilarious. I love this story.
Oh, this is a crazy one because people always, when we first started showing this, this was like 15 years ago, that, oh my gosh, all these things like, plate size or what the person is doing next to you or have a big influence on how much you eat. A lot of people would say, no, they don't, because I know when I'm full. And so we said, okay, great. Well, let's take a look at this. And one of the things we did was we developed this refillable soup bowl, and we invited people in for lunch, and this is a soup bowl that refilled. It was pressure filled, from the bottom of the bowl. We brought people in, and people with a refillable soup bowl in 10 minutes ended up eating about 73% more soup. But when we asked them, if they were full, they go, "No, God, how can I be full? I still have a full bowl of soup left."
Yeah.
Because the things we eat with our eyes and not with our stomach, which is one of the problems why we end up overeating when we're standing with that Ben and Jerry's pint by the freezer eating out of it, kind of going, there's a lot there, and all of a sudden we find ourselves we're at the bottom of the little pint. We're still not full, and we're saying, how did that happen? Mm-hmm. And because of this, it's really good to make sure we turn things in the other direction. If we dish out our chips into a bowl instead of eating them out of a bag, hey, at that moment we can see how good or bad of a boy how good of a boy or bad of a boy or girl we're going to be. And, at that point we say, this is enough. I eat this many chips.
Yeah. I think it's just excellent. Well, another thing you say is the more hassle it is, the less we'll eat. How can we use that to our benefit?
the easiest thing you can do if you're listening to this at the office right now over lunch is to move your candy dish. We found with a study of a number of administrative assistants that when we gave them all the chocolate they could eat, every night we filled up their candy dish. What we found is that when we put it 6 feet away from them versus on their desk, they ended up eating 125 calories less every day. They went from eating like about 9 Hershey Kisses a day down to 4, which over the course of a year is about 9 extra pounds that they would not have gained if they simply moved that dumb bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very easy changes like that that can make a big difference in a person's life, because it just makes things just a little more of a hassle. Because when we ask them, well, is it the problem that walking 6 more feet is that big of an effort? They go, oh, no. What it is that 6 feet makes me say, hey, am I really that hungry? And half the time they'd answer, no.
Yeah. I love that example in your book where you gave of the person who, by creating that distance, there was just enough time for them to pause and think.
Yeah. We actually call it a pause point.
Okay.
And you can use this actually if you're a mindless overeater at dinner time. A lot of guys, what we fall into is that we eat fast. You know, but you know, everybody else just, gosh, I mean, they eat in slow motion. It's just, yeah, it's crazy. And so we're done, and, you know, everybody else is still picking at their first forkful. And so what do? Well, we reach out, we grab the nearest food and put more on our plate. Well, we did a study where we either gave people food on their table, or we gave to them, they had to serve from the stove or from the counter. And we found that if they served from the stove or counter, the typical guy ended up eating about 19% less food. Because, you know, at some point you say, hey, do I really want thirds of that pasta? Eh, not that bad. Not bad enough to get up and walk for it.
Right. If it was sitting in front of me on the table, I might.
Yeah, bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Well, I know that there's, you probably teach or could research, you know, entire year-long courses on comfort foods. But just briefly, if you would, I'd like to just go into a brief area about comfort foods. I think it's so important. I think it's an area that so many people can relate to and have trouble with. But generally speaking, just a quick definition, what are comfort foods? I mean, I think we have a good idea, but it might surprise some people too.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think of comfort foods as foods you eat like when you're, you know, depressed or lonesome or really in need of sort of solace of some sort. But in reality, what we find when we ask people, we've asked over 1,000 people, you know, what are your favorite comfort foods and when do you eat them? About 45% of all people say tag their comfort foods as things that they eat when they're celebrating. And I mean, that's really neat because it's not just the sort of thing that you eat when you're, you know, not feeling that great, but it's also the thing you celebrate with. And I think there's some cool myths about comfort foods, and one of them is that all comfort foods are terrible foods. They're like the chocolate sunny brownie with, you know, flames erupting out of it and, you know, caramel and chocolate on it. But for a lot of people, in fact, about 48% of people, their favorite comfort foods are not decadent, indulgent snack foods, but they're actually reasonably healthy foods. You know, they're steak or their soup or their casseroles, things like this. And what's important to realize about that is that when we ask people to rate different foods in terms of their comfort, a casserole, for instance, for a lot of in general. doesn't end up being rated much lower than a chocolate sundae. And, you know, we find that a steak or pasta isn't rated much lower than cookies and ice cream. And the cool thing about this, it says, hey, wait a minute. If things are so close, you know, in terms of their satisfaction, a person might be a whole lot better off, hey, choosing the soup. You know, or choosing maybe the steak instead of the chocolate sundae instead. Because afterwards, what's going to happen, they will have eaten better, they will have gotten more nutrition, and they'll feel just as satisfied.
And there's a difference between women and men even in the types of foods that are typically considered comfort foods, right?
Yeah. Very good. Yeah, very good. And one of the things we find is that, in general, most women pinpoint their comfort foods as being snack foods. But most guys, if you ask them what their comfort foods are, they're very seldom snack foods, meal foods.
Mm-hmm.
Guys prefer meal foods like steak, the pasta, the casseroles, things like this. And when you ask them why, they kind of say, well, you know, when I think of that, I think of, you know, really being kind of taken care of and, kind of served and really... really an indulgent atmosphere. But with women, when we say, hey, what about this steak, you know, pasta, casseroles, are they comfort foods? They say, you know, we really like them, but they're not comfort foods because when I think of them, I think of either me or my mom having to make them. That's not comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think explains why almost all of their comfort foods end up being things that are, you know, either baked or store-bought. You know, there's the ice cream, there's the cakes, there's the cookies, there's candy, things like this.
Ice cream, chocolate, and cookies, you had said. And then for what I found interesting for the guys, you had said it's ice cream, soup, and pizza, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I find interesting in both those? The first thing is ice cream.
No, yeah, that's the one exception for both groups.
And I actually find that very true among my clients as well. I have said to thousands of them over the years that the number one, what I would say, trigger food, the number one trigger food among all my clients, and anytime I've polled them and asked them directly, is if I just look at just the masses and add it up, it's ice cream. Yeah,
Interesting.
across the board.
Hmm.
So it's not with comfort foods. It's not all about the food. It's what the food does for us and how it makes us feel, and whether we feel pampered, and whether we feel taken care of. And it has to do with memories, and has to do with other associations. And so is there something that what's the maybe not a quick fix, but
Sure.
how can we make comfort foods work for us since we're attached to them so emotionally?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the, I mean, there's a couple things. One of the things that we need to realize is that it's a real fine line. If you just say, "Hey, what are my favorite comfort foods that are unhealthy?" You know, and we can all come up with those. And you say, you know, I guess ice cream would be at the top of the list. And you can say, "What are the comfort foods I have that are reasonably more healthy?" And but we can also come up with those. You know, it might be steak, it might be casserole, whatever. You might be French onion soup with not a lot of butter in it, whatever. But what's important to realize is that in this study we did of it was like 1,005 people or something, there's a real small difference between how satisfied the unhealthy foods made people feel versus how satisfied healthy people feel. But if we asked people 20 minutes later how satisfied they were, they felt a lot happier with themselves and a lot less guilty if they'd eaten the healthy foods rather than the non-healthy foods. And I think the takeaway there is that, hey, look, you know, you're feeling a little down, you feel like you want something to bring you some comfort. Well, think of the healthier foods that bring you comfort. And, you know, basically, if you have them, you're not going to feel any less comfortable than if you had that chocolate flaming volcano fudge sundae. And afterwards, you're going to feel even a whole lot better.
Excellent. Well, I'm gonna again. I know that's year, 2 year long, you know, coursework. If you were to get, you know, deep into it, and probably a whole lot longer than that. It's probably a lifetime of research just to deal with nothing but comfort foods. But we look
It's
at. I want to
crazy,
look at
yeah.
the nutritional gatekeeper,
Sure,
and
sure, sure.
that
Yeah,
nutritional gatekeeper as you define it, and then I want to ask you, what does that nutritional gatekeeper do to keep snacks in the house for the kids, but stay out of the snacks for the kids?
you know, it's a great question. I mean, and one of the things, I mean, we've been doing a lot of stuff with kids lately, and you can find some of this at mindlesseating.org. And then also part of it is going to be at the website slimbydesign.org. It's a new book coming out. But one of the things we find with kids is that we have a lot of myth about kids. And one of our biggest myths is that we can't control what our kids eat. And it's a tremendously comforting myth for us because if we believe that, then we can pretty much give up on the cause. We don't have to try. But what we found in a research up at you know, my Cornell Food and Brand Lab is that the typical parent controls about 72% of what their family eats. And when I say the typical parent, I'm talking about the nutritional gatekeeper, the person who purchases and prepares most of the food in the house. But they control the 72% of what their spouse and their kids eat. They either do it knowingly or unknowingly, and they either do it for the better or for the worse. I mean, they do it for the better if they have a fruit bowl on the counter. They do it for the worse if there's a cookie jar. Okay? They do it for the better if they give their kid a little snack pack to take in their backpack to school. They do it for the worse. They give them $5, say, "Hey, buy whatever you want." And they do it for the better. They end up going to a restaurant that has sort of salads and has fish. They do it for the worst. They go to some place that just serves deep fried split up onion rings. And I think that's really important and empowering for people to realize.
It's absolutely critical in our modern times here. I so agree with you that we've got to do everything we can to reduce childhood obesity. And what I'm going to say we, the adults and parents, are doing to the kids, you know, my firm belief is until a child can drive, the percentage. Well, the way I always say it, my kids now are 23, 21, and almost 19, and I always say the inmates did not run the asylum as they were being raised, and until they could drive, we decided what was in the house, and basically what was in the house is what they ate because they didn't have a way to leave.
And I love it. But you cannot believe the percentage of parents say, "Oh, I can't control my kid. He eats." And no, you can't. You can't control 100% of what they eat.
Right.
They're going to throw some vegetables away. They're going to sneak a piece of gum. But you know, don't focus on the 28% that you can't control. Just celebrate the 72% that you can control and do it right.
Right. Well, for the parents that want to do it right, and let's say they're buying the individual snack packs, or they're buying things properly, and they're buying more fruits and vegetables, but they're still going to keep what we would all consider maybe a little bit of junk food in the house for the kids. The drawer for the kids, the snack drawer or whatever. And
yeah.
Do you have any specific tips for the adults, though, once those foods are in the house to stay out of it?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, the parent who says, nothing will pass my child's lip that isn't organic or homegrown is, I mean, that might work for 18 years. But, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the 19th year when they leave home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in some of these cases, the idea is you want to make the enticing choice or the healthy choice. You want to make it dominate. The other thing, you either want to make it much more convenient, you want to make it more attractive, or you want to make it seem more normal to eat that. And you know, you say, "Hey, welcome home from school. Here's your cut up broccoli." Gee, I mean, you know, even you and I'd go, "Oh, come on! My life's not worth this." But if it gets paired with a little bit of a dip, and it gets paired with some small, like, cheese cubes, it's like, "Oh, hey, this is cool. Thanks."
Mm-hmm.
So it's a part of this magical snack drawer is not to make it the default alternative, but to make the other things that they can go to, you know, even more attractive, even more convenient, and even more normal.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Well, as we move into kind of moving from mindless overeating to mindless better eating, as you describe it, would you just give a quick summary of what food trade-offs and food policy mean?
Right. Well, I think one thing about food trade-offs is that, you know, I mean, there's certain policies people have in their mind, and a policy could be, you know, I will never eat more than half of an indulgent food that's given to me at a restaurant. Okay, that's a policy. And you say, "Great, I'm not going to say no to French fries. You know, I'm not going to say no to my French onion soup. I'm only going to eat half of it." Okay, you know, and that would be a policy. A trade-off would be to say, "Hey, what am I willing to do to really eat what I want?" And so, for example, we do a lot of clinical work with people up here at my Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and we have people who've been sort of directed to us who have eating issues. And we had a guy, I guess maybe a year ago, and his problem was he just couldn't stop overeating in the middle of the day. I mean, in the middle of the afternoon. He had a tremendous problem with this. But I mean, he ate a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we said is, like, you know, and you can say, "Okay, our advice to you is just don't do it. Don't have the food around." And, you know, is that going to work? No way!
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The guy does it for a reason. You can't say just don't do it. I mean, things, his world would blow up. And, and he might say, "Oh, I'll think about it," but that's going to be it. And we said, "You know, you want to do that, and, you know, kind of brings you a lot of benefit. Yeah, you can do it. Here's the deal, though. What you have to do when you start feeling that craving at 3 o'clock is you only have to eat a piece of fruit before you eat your snack. And if you eat the piece of fruit, you can have whatever snack you want. You can have whatever, however much you want to. Can you agree to that? The guy goes, yeah, I can agree to that. But 2 weeks later, what do you suppose happens? We talk to the guy, and how many snacks do you suppose he ate? Like 3 or 4, because what happens is, in some cases, he says, oh, geez, I don't have any fruit. I want a snack, but, I could walk down to this, store and buy a piece of fruit, but, I don't want to do that bad, so I guess I just won't have a snack. In other cases, he actually does eat a piece of fruit, and then he says, oh, I'm not that hungry. And
sure.
In the third case, he actually eats a piece of fruit and then he has a snack. But it's a great example of how you just make a trade-off. Okay, yeah, great. You can have whatever snack you want to at 3:30. You can have, the 4-pound bag of Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to eat a piece of fruit beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy how just making that little bitty trade-off for some people makes them say, I really don't want this that much.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking of another food policy. I have a client who just has a food policy that just is this. I don't drive into fast food. That she doesn't do drive-through at all.
That's a policy, yeah. If it doesn't backfire in other ways, I would even say to her, I said, hey, here's the deal. You can go in any fast food restaurant you want to, and you can buy anything you want to. You just can't go through the drive-thru.
Right.
That's
her policy.
Anything.
Yep.
But, I think it has to be made really explicit so that the person doesn't sort of figure a way to say, oh, forget this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, you can still have it. Really, you can have it. Drive there, walk in, you can have it. Just don't go through the drive-through.
Absolutely. Yep. That's exactly how she actually had it worded better than I said it. Yep. You're absolutely right.
Cool.
Well, as we kind of wrap this up in a practical way, there are lots of things that people can do. And as you said in your book, and I appreciated it so much, there's not a 1, 2, 3 ABC fit for everybody here. There's so many things that are unique to each individual's life and environment and daily schedule and so forth. But is there one or two things? What would be, and if so, what would be the top one or two things that someone could do to start making that difference in their life, moving from mindless overeating to mindless better eating? How would they get started the best?
Yeah. Well, because the thing is, if there were 3 or 4 things, every magazine and every grocery store would be out of business because every one of them comes up with great ideas every time and pick it up and kind of go, oh, yeah, whatever, and throw it away. I think the best thing that a person can do is they can say, the first step is to identify the one area that is most problematic to them today. And again, those 5 areas are, eating too much at dinner time, snacking too often, eating too much at restaurants, eating too much at parties, and eating while you're driving or working at your desktop. And say, which of those things, I can relate to all of them. All normal people can. But which one of those things is most problematic? And if you identify what it is, you can say, what is the one thing I can do every day, not occasionally, every day, that can make a difference? And I think those are that's the greatest thing you can do. Now, a ton of those changes can be found, in the book Mindless Eating. And there's a bunch of them on the website, mindlesseating.org. But, you might invent some of your own, but come up with 1 or 2 consistent changes that are made 30 days out of the next month will move the dial forward so much. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And I think that gives people a place to begin and to do some early analysis and then just take it from there and make the one small change related to that to that thing they know. I always say, start with what you know. There's lots of things people may not know, but if they start with what they know and look at that one area, and then look at one thing that they, as you said, that they can do every day that's small, they can make a difference over the course of time. We'll definitely see a difference in their weight
absolutely.
And health. Well, in kind of, I liked how you summarized an article you had online, and you finished up the article by saying people's tastes are not formed by accident. The more we know about the psychology behind foods, the more we can know about how to help Americans consciously control what they decide to eat. And I think that's just so well said, and so much of what we do, as I've said for 13 years now with Leanest Lifestyle, it's way more than a math problem. It's way more than calories in and calories out. We've got to figure out, what's going on in the mind and what's eating us and why we do what we do, so that we can make it easier to win this and to win it permanently, because that's our focus at Leanest Lifestyle, is to not just get the weight off and do a diet and drop some pounds. Lots of people can do that and they can do it fairly well, but it's to get the weight off and keep it off permanently. And Dr. Wantzink, I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to share your incredible, just a tiny piece of your incredible wealth of knowledge. I recommend everyone read the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you'll get an even more in-depth understanding of just some of the things that Dr. Wantzink and I talked about today. And Dr. Wantzink, if you could just one more time, just give a way for people to learn more about your research and mindless eating, that'd be great.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's two ways. One is to go to the website, mindlesseating.org. And the second is that there's a new book that's coming out. It's coming out on March 19th, 2013. It's called Slim by Design, Mindless Eating Solutions for Everyday Life.
Ooh.
And so
that one's going on my wish list. For sure.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So,
well, great.
There's a Facebook page, and then also if you want to Twitter me, it's Brian Wantzink. Just quote or # Brian Wantzink.
Excellent. Well, thank you again. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I look to follow up. I hope I can follow up with you sometime after March when you launch the book, and I've had a chance to read it and give everyone an insight into that as well. Thank you again, Doctor.
Yeah, we'll make it so.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening. This is David Greenwald of Leanest Lifestyle University. For more information on programs we offer, visit leanestlifestyle.com. That's LEANNESS lifestyle.com. I look forward to working with you personally and through the wonder of an inside-out transformation, helping you to not only turn your body, but your life around.